Good morning. Thank you for coming to this session. So I had a very long title in my talk in the book, and I didn't think it was feasible even try to fit it on the slide. And I actually wanted to instead talk with you about the questions that I'm interested in right now. And so this title now asks three questions that are important to my work. I'm from Iowa State University. And so a big question for me is it over after Stover? Corn Stover, cellulosic ethanol is taking off right now, and we'll know in the next year if it's going to succeed. And then following on that, a lot of similar conversations that we've had this morning about what to put where on the landscape. And then I'm going to talk to you about a vision that I and the people on the slide have for maybe a 15% solution. So I'm interested to hear what you, I hope you challenge me on that. So I have to thank, there's lots of people on this slide. Some of them are from Iowa State, like Lisa Schulte, Moore, Elka Brandes. Some of them are with private industry. David Muth used to be with Idaho National Lab, but now is with a company called Ag Solver. Ian Bonner and Kara Cafferty are still at Idaho National Lab. I work with Furman Milster from the University of Iowa, who runs the power plant there. And then my postdoc, Catherine Bonin, and Allison Snow and Maria Maridi are genomic ecologists at Ohio State. So I'll try to put all this together for you. So first of all, you know, we have functioning cellulosic ethanol plants now in Iowa. I feel like Iowa is sort of ground zero for some of this right now because with Abengoa, Project Liberty there in the northwest part of the state, and then DuPont's facility just right adjacent to Iowa State opening this winter, we're gonna be the testing ground, I think, for some of the cellulosic ethanol story. And that story is based on corn right now. That, you know, it's maps like these that drove the decision to start early cellulosic ethanol facilities on corn stover. And we've worked so much on corn that we now have maps like this. So this is one of my favorite figures out of South Dakota State University, paper in PNAS last year, showing the areas of the upper Midwest that have been converted from grasslands into corn or soybean fields. And this map only goes up to 2011. So if it's yellow there, you know, about 15% of the land that was in grasses went to corn soy. If it's red, that's 30%. And if you look at Iowa, where, you know, we've got some hot spots there. So I'll come back to this in a little bit. But I think, you know, for our discipline, maps like these to me are really important because, you know, no one comes to Iowa. Everybody flies over Iowa, right? So this is the way that people on coasts see Iowa, right? You can see it from space. There's no need to actually go there. And so when we're thinking about policy making or decision making, this to me is really important. You know, New Zealand actually has nitrate policies, right? So it's legislated that you can't put too much nitrogen on. And they use satellites to look where sheep are to understand that there's going to be more nitrogen in that area. So people, you know, hide their sheep with, you know, sheds that look like grass and things like that. So it's satellite imagery, I think, that's going to become really important for monitoring some of our nutrient issues. So here's the story that I want to tell you in case you want to sleep for the rest of the time. So I'm going to try to make a case that there's profitability, environmental, and energetic reasons to put 15% of the land within Iowa fields into perennials. So I'm going to show you that 15% of land within Iowa fields is currently not profitable, that planting 15% of land within Iowa fields to diverse perennial provides a disproportionate benefit, more bang for your buck, and that planting 15% of that land to perennial high-yielding energy crops can provide enough biomass. And I'm also going to take a brief detour to talk about miscanthus invasive potential since I have these people in the room. I want to hear your thoughts on that. Okay, profitability. So this is now Dave Muth, Ian Bonner, and Kara Cafferty's work. So what you're looking at on the left is about a 100-acre field in the north central part of Iowa. So this is, you know, beautiful flat prime farmland. And the colors there indicate the profitability of that field. So yellow, if you look at the very top, negative $933 an acre profitability in some of those pixels, all the way up to positive $600 an acre. And there's definitely caveats. This is measured and modeled data that you're seeing. But the point is that, you know, when you drive by a field and you see yellow spots or you see empty spots, you intuitively know, right? The whole field is not functioning at a really high level. It's just the average that makes things work. But we can now see maps like this, and we have the data to back them up. So the scenario on the right just imagines that if you took out the acres within that, or the parcels within that field, that we're operating at less than $250 an acre loss. So not zero, negative $250 an acre loss. You end up taking about 12% of the acres out of that field, But look what you do to the profit. So you're farming 88% of the field, but you raise the average profit by $10. You half the standard deviation in that field. So I think this is interesting for lots of reasons, but one of them is, you know, I feel like we can now show maps like these to taxpayers. You know, like, I pay a lot of money for crop insurance, right? And I don't necessarily want to. There's areas of this field, we have long-term yield monitor data for that. That's a sandy ridge, that yellow area on the side there. So we know that some acres or some parcels in this field have never made money, ever, in the 20 years for which we have yield monitor data. And they're probably hemorrhaging nitrogen because of the inputs that we're putting on this field. It's also sloped in that part of the field. So to me, this is like showing an insurance company a population of people and saying, pierce the 12 smokers in this room. Do you want to insure them at the same rate that you insure all the other healthy people in this room? I think maps like this, to me, I don't want to insure those acres. And this now shows that sort of aggregated at the county level now for 4 years in Iowa, 2010 through 2013, highly variable years, right? We had floods, we had droughts. And there's counties in Iowa that have 30,000 to 65,000 acres in them that are losing more than $200 an acre a year. So there's spots within these places that are important. So what I want to point out too on this map is that Des Moines is right around here. Ish. Oh, thanks. So the Des Moines, so there's the Raccoon River watershed drains into the water supply for the city of Des Moines. The city of Des Moines has the world's largest nitrate removal system. So China comes to Iowa to figure out how to get stuff out of water. So if you look at the, you know, where there's perhaps opportunity to remove some of that nitrate with perennials, like John was mentioning, I think we have that opportunity. So now from a biomass perspective, we're back to that same field I was showing you, now talking about corn stover removal. So if we're talking about working with DuPont or Poet and how do we put together a fuel shed, here's how much stover could be removed from the baseline scenario, and that's right in target with some of the numbers that we're seeing in practice, sort of about 1.6 to 1.8 tons an acre on really, really prime farmland is about the limit that we can get for corn stover right now. If you throw some switchgrass in those pixels, not commenting yet about whether or not that's feasible, engineering or cost-wise, but you can considerably raise the amount of biomass you could remove. So here's the sort of value proposition for increasing feedstock supply. This is just sort of some rough numbers about what it does to water quality if you did this. Of course, this is all modeled with a water quality index from the NRCS. But the baseline scenario, so bluer is better, purple is great in this picture. And if you add switchgrass, you get more blue. So you get cleaner water. It's pretty intuitive, but we haven't really measured this at the landscape scale because it's hard. So that's the profitability. That's the profitability portion of that presentation. But now I'm going to talk to you about the environmental portion. So some of you might know I've worked on miscanthus for most of my career. These are my plots. That I did my PhD on switchgrass in the foreground and miscanthus in the background. And if anyone knows Matt Liebman from Iowa State, he's 6 foot tallish. And when he came to Illinois in 2006 and looked at this. And I was just coming out with some work that was saying that if we put 10% of our land area into high-yielding crops like miscanthus, we could meet our entire RFS2 goals. So Matt thought that was interesting for another reason, because he'd been working on, he and lots of other people that are authors on this talk, had been working on putting prairie strips into row crop systems. So not biomass crops in the traditional sense, but diverse perennials. And they did this in a watershed approach. This was one of my favorite experiments that I've ever seen. So these kernel-looking things represent small watersheds. And they essentially did a green eggs and ham sort of configuration with perennials. Like they put a little bit at the bottom, they put a little less at the bottom, put some in strips, a little more in strips, and looked at the difference between a no-till corn soy system. The reason I like this study so much is because there's a lot of stuff measured, not modeled. So they actually put in flumes at the bottom of all those watersheds in a replicated design and measured what came out. This is the amount of sediment coming out of a no-till corn soy system. So, you know, this is for us a conservation system. No-till corn is a conservation practice in Iowa. And I wouldn't say it's conserving very much. So if you add some perennials to that, you get cleaner water. If you have a lot of perennials, you get even cleaner water. This is not Matt Helmer's work. It's getting cut off there at the bottom. here's the data that's showing that. So we have every other year we have a 500-year flood in Iowa, and this is showing sediment export from the row crop system in 2010 or 2008 there. We had another one in 2010. But the point here is, no matter what configuration of perennials are in the system, just 10% is enough to stop 90% of that sediment from running off the field. And if any of you know what prairie looks like in the first year after planting, I mean, that's weeds there that's stopping that sediment. So it doesn't have to be even great diversity, just some diversity. So here's the sort of cumulative numbers from that. There's been a series of papers now on this work. But so again, coming back to that 15% number, if we add 10 to 20% of prairie to crop fields, we show disproportionate benefits in the amount of water that runs off that field, the amount of nitrogen that's in that runoff, the amount of phosphorus that's moving with soil. We don't know the numbers for dissolved phosphorus, which is increasingly looking to be important in these types of systems with tile drainage. And of course, a big reduction in soil loss. Importantly, this happens without reducing yields. So in some cases, we've actually seen a slight yield benefit because of increased diversity in the system, so protecting against pests and disease issues. We have a little bit of improvement there through natural predators, most likely. Importantly, this is way cheaper than installing terraces. So in landscapes like the Central Great Plains, we just take bulldozers and move soil to try to slow the runoff of water from fields. And there's a lot of people who make money on that. They own farmers that own bulldozers. And so it's kind of entrenched in our system. But those terraces have been blowing out with the sort of, you know, huge rains that Goble mentioned earlier. Prairie strips don't blow out. They last. So this is quite cost effective. So this is now being incorporated happily into Farm Service Agency planning. There's a pollinator program that will support addition of prairie strips into farm landscapes. So now the energy story. So same slide, now talking about some of my work. I'm going to skip right to talking to you about a project that we're working on with the University of Iowa to put, so the University of Iowa is retrofitting their power plant, like a lot of universities kind of want to do. They're actually sticking with it, unlike most universities, and they're going to be 40% renewable energy by 2020. And they're doing that through a variety of mechanisms, but a large one is that they want to only burn biomass. Iowa doesn't have fossil fuel resources, so we import coal to make heat and steam. We make heat and electricity at our universities. And that coal, so the University of Iowa spends $10 million a year out of state on coal, and they would like to spend $10 million a year in state in this area on biomass resources. And this is some mapping that we've done to show where that biomass might come from. And there's plenty of land to do it. We only need about 10,000 acres. In this case, to put on miscanthus. They expect miscanthus to provide about 25% of their total renewable portfolio. So we're signing up farmers. We're looking now to get 2,500 acres in the next 2 years. This is a field from a field day we had with one of the pilot farmers. That's a first-year miscanthus stand. That's the best miscanthus stand I've ever seen in year one in the central U.S., and that was planted by Reprieve. They did it by just hammering it with inputs, in my opinion. That was planted at about 10 to 20 times the normal planting rate for miscanthus. So it was just the ground was just covered in rhizomes, and we covered it up. And then with decent amounts of herbicide and nitrogen fertilizer, and it worked. And so we don't have this is a pilot field, not a research field, so we don't have good greenhouse gas accounting or life cycle analysis to say whether or not it's worth it. But my hunch is establishing a good miscanthus crop early is better than letting it linger and take a long time over 3 years. So we're able now, working with farmers like these, if we show them maps like I showed you earlier, we can work with them to say, do you want to put something like this on the spots of your fields that are maybe not doing so well? And I can show you which spots in your field are not doing so well. And then we have, in this fuel shed at least, a market. When the power plant is actively looking for farmers, and they're working on 10-year long-term contracts. So I always tell people there's lots of reasons to grow bioenergy crops, but money's not one of them. So, or at least perennial biomass crops in Iowa, there's no market. Now we actually have one, so it's a great test case. Now I'm going to take a brief detour to talk about that miscanthus invasive potential question. So miscanthus giganteus is the clone that I've been talking about this whole time, the Illinois clone. Here on the left is an ornamental Miscanthus sinensis. How many of you have Miscanthus sinensis in your yards? Oh, come on, two? Seriously? Well, so it's probably your bank or your dry cleaner. It's a really commonly planted ornamental. How many of you have seen Miscanthus saccharifloris? Yeah, so if you're in the upper northwest, you see ditches that look like this. And I hadn't seen that before until I moved to Iowa. So I am uniquely in a place where Miscanthus saccharifloris is feral, so it's moved into ditches. People plant it there for dust control or water control. And in some cases, it just gets spread by snowplows and mowers. And then they have all these yards with Miscanthus sinensis. You wouldn't think that would necessarily be problematic, even though they have crossed in the past. They don't have similar flowering times, and they have really quite different reproductive strategies. Sinensis makes seed. Saccharifloris depends on rhizome propagation to spread. It doesn't make a lot of seed. And so this is all pollen limited. It's clonal. Or it was. So what we've been doing with Allison Snow's group is I was curious about the saccharifloris. No one had ever really talked about it too much. And so we went out to some of these patches around Iowa, and we started pulling some tissue samples and looking at markers. And what happened, at first we just had these long 2-mile stretches in a ditch, right? And we didn't see much variability. But then in 2010, one of those floods that I showed you, we had a flood in August, and it was 95 degrees for, you know, it was August. And we had inundated water conditions for about a 2-week period, right about the time that saccharifloris seed was starting to mature, not really mature, but starting to mature. And we started seeing little patches after that. So I think there was some seed there, because all of a sudden there's new patches. And if we look at the diversity in populations, we see normally, so now this is Evan Mutege's work at Ohio State, but we look, for the most part, the populations are clonal. There's no genetic diversity, especially compared to feral sinensis populations in the eastern part of the state. But there's little pockets of diversity. It's starting to show up, and this was 1 year of sampling. We've since done this again. There's more diversity showing up. The smaller patch we sample, the more diversity we have. So this is something that I'm trying to pay attention to. Before you know, you go too far down a road of Giganteus and you're trying to work with growers, which you know we're actively doing, I want to have a little bit of data to say whether or not the good grass is different than the bad grass and how you tell that, because I think in this case, maybe like a lot of families, I think the parents might mess it up for the kid here. I'm a little bit worried that saccharifloris and sinensis could be problematic for a larger spread adoption of Giganteus. So to conclude, I like to see an Iowa crop portfolio, so a mixed mosaic on the landscape of different crops that exploit those small pixels that I showed you earlier of poor profitability. And if we do that, I think we can clean up corn. So it's just going to take 15% of the land in Iowa fields to let people keep doing all the bad things they've been doing with corn. We don't have to change the corn system. We just need to complement it. And I think, you know, this is a picture from the 80s in Iowa, closer to Wisconsin, but this is alfalfa integrated into strips with corn. We used to do it. It shouldn't be a crisis to try to do it again, if it makes dollars and cents. So that's the story, and hopefully we can go from a picture like this to a picture like this. It's a little bit more of an integrated system. I didn't mention animals today, but I think integrating animal agriculture with crop agriculture has to happen to a better degree than it is today. And so, wait the next time you fly over. This is how people think of Iowa, right? They look at those maps. I don't know if I have time for questions.
Yeah, we do have time for several questions. Yes.
I might have another question. I just want to. My name is Mark Bieber, where I'm from. I'm the chair of the diversity committee of this society. And we have some high school students from local high schools that are over there in front. So we brought them here so that they can see science in action, okay? Because we need scientists in the future. So that is why you see them here. So whenever you see them around, they'll be around all day. So just give them a hand.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Ray?
Ray?
With the big changes that are going on in agriculture right now, I was up in Iowa, and we talked about cover crops, and I understand the challenges. But to get to that 15%, if cover crops do start taking place, where they can actually grow a certain amount of biomass, I understand the
Yep. So Dave Moose Group also models actually a paper just came out in Energies last 2 weeks ago from Ian Bonner at Idaho National Lab showing what happens if you put in cover crops. And so cover crops themselves probably won't make much of a difference towards the feedstock supply. What they do is enable harvesting of more corn stover. So the total feedstock availability goes up with the addition of cover crops, but it's simply because it makes it easier to get corn off the field if it's in a no-till system. That's part of what we're trying to figure out right now. So how to make these identified pixels operational and where to functionally place these crops in the landscape. So I work pretty closely with our ag engineering group at Iowa State, who works with DuPont and Pioneer and POET as they're scaling these acres. So, you know, when I look at this map of, you know, here's the places that we need to target perennials, especially when we couple this with biogeochemistry models that show us nitrate leaching, for example. And Matt Darr, my colleague, looks at that and says, there's no way in hell I can drive a combine around that. You know, so we have to work that out. But I think the STRIPS work, the work where they're, you know, integrating the perennials throughout the field, really demonstrates to me that it can't all be at the bottom of the hill. You can't let all the good dirt run down to the bottom of the hill and then just keep farming closer and closer to the ditch, which is what we do today. So we'll see how that plays out. Jeff?
Yeah, I really like the talk. It looks nice. The system looks good. Did you include in your analysis land tenure issues? Most of the land you didn't have 70% rented.
Yeah.
Year to year. And that's kind of a game changer for adoption of some of these things.
Absolutely. So something that we're trying to do, and it's really, really hard, so I would like to talk more about this with you, but Lisa Schulte Moore is helping to head up and actually funded by the Iowa State Department of Agronomy because the work is, in my opinion, really risky, but I think really impactful, is we're incorporating people into agroecosystem models. So using agent-based modeling and other types of social modeling tools, we're trying to actually incorporate decision-making into the ecosystem function. And doing that through a variety of mechanisms, but understanding that land tenure matters and gender matters. So 50% of land in Iowa is also owned by women in some cases. So, you know, how you factor in all the different, there's a lot more than money that's controlling decision-making. And we really only give credence to money, but money is not the most important thing when it comes to decision-making. And I hadn't fully appreciated that until recently.
Well, I think we'll have to wrap it up there.
Okay. Thank you.